Counselor Accents Podcast. Two school counselors who love their jobs. Oh, and they happen to have Southern accents too. Bless their hearts.
I'm Laura Rankhorn, and we are missing Kim Crumley, who is the other half of Counselor Accents. Today, I am so excited to have Dr. Ruby Payne as our special guest today. Kim and I have been talking about poverty and how that's going to be shifting with COVID-19. And as we were talking, I said, why don't we get the specialist on poverty? That's Dr. Ruby Payne, because I knew her from reading her book, A Framework for Understanding Poverty. And she has graciously agreed to be on our podcast today. And Dr. Payne, I can't tell you how honored I am to be able to talk with you today.
Oh, thank you. Well, I am thrilled to be here with you today. And educators are so close to my heart.
Oh, well, tell us a little bit about your background and how this became your platform. And I know it's grown since I read your book. So tell us about yourself.
I started out as a high school teacher for 9 years. And then I was in central office. Then I worked for regional service centers. Then I was an elementary principal. And I student taught at middle school.
That's
where I learned about sex. Okay. Not all of it was correct, but... And then I wrote the book, A Framework for Understanding Poverty. And so I became a consultant then and started the company. And then since that time, I've written a book a year and a half ago about emotional poverty, some of the issues there. But I learned a lot about poverty from my former husband, who died in 2010.
Oh.
Grew up in extreme poverty, came originally out of West Virginia, and then I met him in Indiana in his neighborhood. And that's how I learned about how poverty actually works in the reality of. So that's what prompted this whole thing, though, was I was professional director of professional development in Baytown, Texas, which was just east of Houston on I-10. I had a principal come to me one summer and she said, Ruby, you've got to help me. She said, last year I had 800 students and 900 discipline referrals. And she said, if I have a year like this again, I won't make it. So I said to her, what's your data say? And she said, well, the data doesn't help. And so I knew she wasn't collecting the right data. So I said, tell me a story, because she was a beginning principal. And the research is that when you're becoming an expert in anything, you collect first stories, okay? From the stories, you make patterns, okay? So I said, okay, tell me a story. And I'm going to tell you the story she told me, because this is what started the work, okay, the book, okay? She said, I got two sets of twins in the building. They wear two sets of clothing. They wear one set one day and one set the next. So I said, for the holidays, could I give them $200 for clothes? And the mother said, yes. So she gave him the money for clothes, and the girls came back after the holidays with the same clothes. And she said to the girls, she called them in, she said, what happened to the money? I said, well, we bought a DVD player. And I said, well, if I was the mother, I would have done that too. And she said, you can't be serious. And I said, I am. I said, look, poverty's painful. And a priority for your money is entertainment. Okay. It takes away the pain. And she said, but they needed those clothes. And I said, and did they ask you for them? And she said, no. I said, so how did you decide? Well, anyway, she was having so much difficulty with the concept. I finally told her a story from Wealth and asked her this question. So I'll ask you the question I asked her.
Okay.
Because for a while, my former husband was a bond trader in the Chicago Board of Trade. So we were thrown in with really wealthy people. Okay.
Gotcha.
And I was in this woman's home. I had an income of probably $6 million a year. She did, but she's a bitter woman because she believes she's poor. Yeah, because she knew somebody had a fully staffed and maintained yacht, and she didn't. Okay. She probably had $21, $22 million worth of original art in her home, okay? And I recognized one as a Picasso, and I made the mistake of saying that looks like a Picasso. It was a $1.4 million Picasso. I learned that if you want to insult someone in wealth, all you have to do is infer that their artwork is a replica, you know?
Oh my goodness.
So I said to the principal, so this is the question I'll ask you that I asked her. I said, so if someone gave you a $1.4 million Picasso, what would you do with it?
I would sell it.
Exactly. I said, because you'd be thinking, I lived this long without a Picasso, I'll bet I can live some more.
That's a good point.
I said, that's what the girls were thinking about their clothes.
Such a good point. And I was talking to somebody last week, and we were talking about poverty, and just the mindset is completely different. Someone had offered to buy someone's dinner, and they didn't have anything to their name. So you think, you don't have money to be throwing away to buy someone's dinner. But they said, it won't make a house payment, so I might as well spend it on a meal. And so the frame of reference is just different from our frame, or somebody else's frame of reference. It's like you said, perspective, the $6 million compared to a fully staffed yacht, just the mindset shift. Yeah.
That's right, yeah. And so what's going to, one of the things I've been following, as I'm sure everybody has, COVID, and how that will change people's priorities. Mm-hmm. It already has. Mm-hmm. People are realizing, no, I don't have to shop retail. I love shoes, you know, but I'm learning, hey, I don't need those shoes. And furthermore, right. There's no place to wear them, okay?
Right.
And so you, and then you start thinking, well, did I ever need those shoes? And so what I think people in the work, we define poverty not just about money, but about 8 resources. And because resources stabilize your reality, and poverty actually comes when your resources get destabilized. And then it's kind of like a cascade, okay? Mm-hmm. One destabilizes, another destabilizes, another destabilizes, another, and pretty soon there are virtually no resources, and the world is pretty unpredictable. And for many of our students right now, there's been one more piece that has not happened to my knowledge base in my lifetime. And that is, schools serve as the primary safety net for children, and they serve as the primary distributor of resources, particularly if you're from poverty, okay? Mm-hmm. So like vaccination records, those go through the schools, okay? Child abuse referrals, those go through the schools. Counting children, that goes through the schools. And one of the things is, you start looking and how the system, schooling system, really acts as a safety net and a stabilizer for children. And that's gone.
That is so true. Yes, and you're so right. I hadn't thought, I think about the lunches that are provided, the meals, breakfast and lunch, and we even provide dinner in our school system. And I had thought about that, but I hadn't thought about how they're the keeper of the records. And I had thought about the child abuse reports and everything. But it is that safety sense of security has been taken from
school. Well, and it's the delivery system for children.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you're from poverty, it's yours. Keeps you alive, okay, yeah. Many times, and that's gone. And that net is gone. And that, I think, is like I was talking to a high school teacher in one of the Native American Indian reservations in Arizona. She has 150 high school kids, okay? She only has been able to contact 6.
Whoa, out of 100.
So out of 150. So you begin to get this concept of lost children, mm-hmm. and their needs, yeah.
Well, I think that's a good segue into a question I have for you. knowing that in your book you talk about generational poverty and the difference between that and situational poverty. And let me say, I read your book while I was in school, and now I work at a school, and I'm thinking I need to go back and read this book because it's a completely different mindset when you're in the thick of it compared to when you're writing a paper about it. So I'm going to go back in and dig into it. But what systems can schools start to put in place now, school leadership teams, to prepare for this situational poverty when schools reopen?
Well, the first thing I would recommend, and I've been recommending to schools, is they work very hard to find their kids, okay, right now. In other words, like there is a school district in Oklahoma, they're in a rural area, okay? And what they do is every Friday, they have the bus drivers run the routes.
Oh, wow.
And they stop at every house that they picked up children before, and they honk the horn.
What a great idea.
And they wait to see if kids come out, okay?
Okay.
I also know rural schools, they're using their school buses to deliver food and work packets. But okay, the bottom line, are you figuring out where they are, okay? Phone calls, just as some way to daily check in to, do you know where your children are, okay? One school district of a major city in Corpus Christi School District, they said right now, this was of last week, they knew where 83% of their kids were. Dallas ISD says they know where 99% of their kids are, which I would say is phenomenal.
Yes.
But the issue is, that would be step one, where are they? Okay, that would be the first thing I'd do. And then the second thing I'd try to do is establish a one-on-one relationship with, take all your students in your build, all your staff members in your building, custodians, aides, everybody, and divide your student population into 15 or 20 kids. And then what you do, or by divide your student population by the number of staff. Okay, bus drivers, I mean everybody. And one of the things they do every week is call those 15 kids or find some way to keep in touch with them.
That is so good. Very practical and very doable.
Right. And then the second thing, once you know where they are, then the next two questions, do they have food?
Mm-hmm.
And number two, are they safe? And they're not all going to tell you that. I just wrote a paper, and when we're done, I'll send it to you. You can make it available with these podcasts if people want to download it. But when you're domestic violence calls are up by 35% right now, and child abuse reports are down significantly. But someone told me, and I haven't been able to verify this, that in Dallas, this was from a friend of mine who has a friend who's a nurse, that in the emergency room of this Dallas hospital, they usually got 3 to 4 kids a week from Department of Public Safety for child abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're getting 5 and 6 a day. So the bottom line is it's happening, but the safety net is not there. So I would be looking at the kinds of things you see when you get online to see if the child is okay.
Wow, you've just made my brain go in 100 different directions at one time, because what that tells me is, I'm gonna say school counselors, but educators in general are providing that proactive catch it before it happens. And now we're in a sense of reaction when these cases do present in the emergency rooms or in the police department. And so it shows me that we've been very proactive in catching the things, and what can we do to improve that? So,
in fact, the research is that the majority of child abuse reports come out of the school system.
I believe it. Yeah, I always tell teachers, you're on the front lines. And so you know, let us know, we'll work together on it. But thinking about the upper class, middle class, and the poverty level, every class is vulnerable with this COVID pandemic. People can lose their jobs, whether they work at the gas station or whether they're a CEO. So it's not a respecter of persons. So let's talk about the different classes and how you think they will respond and where you see them bouncing back or not. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, some of them are never going to bounce back. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. The second thing is that in one of the, let me start with generational poverty, two generations of more poverty. One of the most interesting pieces of research that came out of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina was that in poor neighborhoods, generational poverty neighborhoods, people who made it out were people who had more social capital than people who did not. In other words, did they have relationships and support systems? Okay. Because when all your resources dissolve, and the one that is the most important is physical, and I think as people are figuring out right now, you lose your health, you lost everything. Okay. Mm-hmm. 75% of personal bankruptcies are related to a physical illness, a medical thing. So you lose that resource, and it's then everything else craters beyond that. Okay. Your social connections crater, your emotional connections crater. You might have mental losses, you know. So one of the things that happens is your money craters. And so the one resource that nobody can take away from you if you is spiritual and belief in divine guidance and belief in support, it's the resource that's most related to resiliency. But the thing is that they start cratering. So in generational poverty, it was the people. And when things crater, what happens in extreme poverty is it boils down to two things: food and water and relationships. Those are the two basic things you have to stay alive. And people go, you can stay alive without relationships. And I said, and absolutely you cannot, because relationships help you give food and water.
Right.
When there's scarcity, it boils down to those two things. Mm-hmm. And food is the greatest thief. Not having it takes everything away from your ability to think. It mm-hmm. takes your physical strength. It takes away your moral code. You'll do anything for food. I mean, so what you see is it boils down, and as resources shake out in the bottom, that's it. So in generational poverty, it was the people who kept them alive after Hurricane Katrina, okay? And you learn to barter, and you learn to share. In middle class, okay, you get identity from your job, your achievement. Well, if you lose that, okay, then there's a huge sense of failure, okay, and shame. Now, there won't be as much pride and shame this time around is because it's happened to everybody, okay? And I think a lot of people are just grateful to have their life, okay? But the thing is, what happens when people tumble like this is, okay, you lost your, they can't get unemployment right now because there are too many people calling. More than one person my hairdresser has called for 3 weeks. She can't get through, okay? So what you have is this kind of gap where there's no funding, okay? Mm-hmm. All right. Food becomes the issue. And how do you then rent? How do you afford a place to stay? How do you get food? If you have children, it's particularly frightening because they're hungry. One of the things that happened in Cherry Creek, Colorado, which is an affluent suburb right out of Denver, in the 2008 recession, when so many people lost their jobs, you had upper middle class families in these homes. The mortgages were unbelievable. And the bottom line is they paid the mortgage, so they had a place to be, but their children were hungry. But they wouldn't apply for food, because free and reduced lunch, because of the shame.
Wow.
But this time I think that there'll be less shame because it's happening to everybody. All right. But the thing then becomes is, how do you deal with the loss of resources, and they tumble, okay? And then in wealth, the issue is different. Like in new money and old money, okay? Mm-hmm. new money is about having your own business and making your own wealth. And typically the fastest way to create your own wealth is through your own business. Well, you look what's happening to people. I know of one man, he owns 47 high dollar restaurants. Okay. He shut them down.
Wow. Mm.
So the thing is, if he owned those properties as opposed to lease them, he's got to pay real estate tax on it. Mm-hmm. He can't pay that. Okay. He's got liabilities on equipment, on this, on that. He can't pay that. So things start to tumble. All right. Right. And then you have to figure out, and in an old money, that is another story on itself. The church I go to has some old money in it, okay? And I've old oil money.
Okay.
Well, right now, today, oil was $8 a barrel, okay? What that means is that in old money, you live off your revenue from your trust fund, all right? Well, two things have happened right now to people. One, their principal got cut significantly in the stock market. Mm-hmm. What they say in the stock market is that you should count on being able to spend 4% of your liquid assets a year and keep your principal. So for example, you have $1 million in your trust fund, 4% of that is 40,000, okay? Well, what has happened now, the principal in the trust fund has tumbled, okay? Mm-hmm. So you're not getting the revenue off of that, okay? So now what do you do? And you have properties that have been passed down inheritance-wise, but they still have taxes on them. And you have domestic help, okay? And you have club memberships. And you, what do you do, okay? And so you start spending your principal. So one of the things is there's this huge anxiety then that comes from in old money, because you're looking at the trust to help you through this time. And then a lot of people don't know this, but if it's like 3 and 4 generations of money, it's not unusual that the trusts are written that if you're female, you cannot work outside the home for money.
Wow. I did not know that.
So you can only volunteer.
Oh, wow.
So it becomes this huge dynamic then about, so then the institutions you support. So like I know in the church I go to, when the 2008 recession hit, several of the people in that church who live off trust funds couldn't pay their tithes. They would call their clubs they were members of and say, you know, I want to keep my membership, I'll pay the dues, but I won't be using your club because I can't afford to.
Wow.
So you see the tumbling effect of things across the board, yeah. Mm-hmm. But to have it on this massive of a scale means that even if you have assets, it's going to be hard to sell them.
Right. Yes, because it has impacted so many. And so I do wonder about like the housing market and just so much. I know we haven't seen the lasting impact of what this is going to bring. We haven't seen the end of it yet. So that's alarming. It's concerning. And I feel a little bit hypocritical in like when I was coming up with questions to talk with you about today, I thought, this really feels hypocritical that now I'm saying, what can schools do to put these systems in place when really they should have been in place already? We should be taking care of, and we are to a degree. I know this is just a bigger scale, but it just felt very hypocritical that now let's snap into gear and do something to help people. So I don't know.
Well, I think that you have to have the political will to do that. And you have to have a compelling reason to do it. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have either one. And it's like, you know, when you're It's like when you have a flat tire on your car and you knew you had a bad tire, you know, and then it goes flat in the middle of a rainstorm and you go, dang it, why didn't I realize this, you know? And I think there's some of that going on too, but I think there wasn't the political will.
Yeah. And now there is. Yeah, and that's true.
Now there is.
You talked about this being on such a bigger scale, and maybe that will ease the, like you said, the shame in accepting help. But what role does pride play in people accepting help?
Well, traditionally, it is seen as if you need help, that says that the underlying message is you're inadequate. Mm-hmm. There's something wrong with you. You're unable. Now I think that's probably one of the good things about this. It is like, okay, we're all in this.
Yeah.
It's nothing I did personally to make this happen.
Yeah, that's a good point and a good distinction.
Yeah.
And something that you mentioned in your book was it happens in poverty level two, where there is the pride in poverty level two. So that was really eye-opening and interesting to read.
What's going to be hard is middle class, because one of the things for middle class is there's such huge identity and role, what you do for work. And work is such a key in situational poverty and middle class. And one of the things that's not been explored at all is this. What do you do when you don't have work? And for males, it's particularly damaging. There's a fabulous African-American sociologist out of Harvard. His last name is Wilson, and he wrote a book called When Work Disappears.
Hmm.
He said, if you want to break a culture, all you have to do is take work away from men, because it changes identity. And so I think one of the things that happened in the Great Depression is that we went forward with the public works program, and it made a huge difference for people because people could work.
Hmm.
And paid for their work. And I think that this pandemic will change the American thinking in many ways, okay? One of the things is that I think when this is over, and we either have a vaccine or much better testing, you will see people wanting to operate in groups more. Mm-hmm. And you will see relationships being much more important to people than they've been before.
Wow. I can see that. That's true.
And I'm hoping that it will change the our institutional rigidity. I am hoping that we'll see, you know, children, students have a name, and we've been treating them as a data point.
Hmm.
I would be so grateful if we would go back to seeing them as individual human beings.
Whoo, that just gave me chills. That's so good. That is so good. And as a school counselor, that definitely hits. I know so many of our listeners, that's going to hit their strong point too. You know, you're going to hit their heart as well with that comment, because we do lump so many students together in so many things, the way they learn, the way we educate them. And we have such an opportunity right now to change everything and make it more individualized. And I hope that we don't lose sight of that opportunity that we have.
Oh, me either. And one of the good news, I just saw how Denmark opened their schools yesterday.
Okay.
And here's how they're doing it. They have 15 kids in a class, and they've got them spread out 6 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They're going out for recess for a while. They're washing their hands. Everybody is every hour. Okay. And I thought, how fabulous to teach with only 15 kids.
Yeah.
And the issue becomes, how then do you do secondary? I was talking to a couple of secondary principals, and it was like, okay, if you can't have more than 50 people together at one time, how are you going to do passing periods in the hall?
Hmm.
And how are you going to stagger classes so you don't have, and how do you set up your classrooms so that you keep the 6-foot deal? Mm-hmm. So I see this as some fabulous opportunities to rethink some of the things we're doing. Okay. Right. But the other thing that's been abundantly clear is that online schooling is just not the panacea that everybody thought it would be.
That's a good point.
Well, you actually need a human being.
You're right. And it goes back to what you said about relationships and how if that is one of our basic needs, I'm using Maslow terms now, but if that's one of our basic needs, then face-to-face is not going to do it. And there have been studies that, not face-to-face, but screen-to-screen, I guess. There have been studies that show that you can have a baby and talk to it, you know, face-to-face, mother to baby, and then they take an iPhone and have the same mother talk to the same baby, and there's not as much reaction as there is when they're face-to-face. So that has been in my mind as we've been trying to do education.
Well, let me tell you why. I wrote a book called Emotional Poverty that came out a year and a half ago. And the reason I wrote it was simply, see, if you're not a counselor or you're not in special ed, you get no information about emotion and how emotion is tied into learning. Okay, none. Okay. And so you don't have a vocabulary. And what's happening in schools right now is we're trying to treat an emotional issue as if it were a discipline issue, and it's not, okay? It is not.
Oh, my goodness.
And educators don't have any vocabulary for it, okay? Well, one of the things, and I just finished a second book called Emotional Poverty Book 2, but in the second book, well, in the first book, but in the second book, I talk about the energy that comes out of a body. And when you were talking about the research on screens and babies, I'll ask an audience this question. Have you ever been in a room with an angry person? So let me ask you that. Have you ever been in a room with an angry person?
I have.
Could you feel their anger?
I could.
Yeah, right. Okay. And you know why? Because the waves from your heart go 3 feet out from your heart.
Oh, wow.
They go that far out from your heart. So your body is both a chemical system and an energy system. And it's an electromagnetic system, so it actually goes out. We know from the hard research that emotions are contagious. So, but part of that contagion is in that relationship, that energy exchange. And you don't get that energy exchange in a screen.
You're right. Wow.
So I am like, oh, you know, I've said for years, guys, there was an article written in 1910. That's when they invented the ballpoint pen.
Uh-huh.
That the ballpoint pen would eliminate the need for teachers.
Oh, my. Oh, wow. Well, that kind of gives hope to some teachers, doesn't it? That feel like maybe their job could be replaced by the computer. Yeah, maybe not, huh?
Nope. It's always been a social thing.
Yeah.
Learning is social.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is. And those relationships are what inspire children to want to learn. And there's so much that we could talk about.
I know, but it inspires you and me too.
Yeah, it does. And that sort of goes along with another question I had for you. In your book, the first chapter gripped me because, like you said, the way to data is through telling stories. And so in the framework for understanding poverty, you give these case studies and all throughout the book. And that's where I really can see, like, you become a part of the situation. So that's what kind of opened my eyes to, we need to be preparing now. Yes. For things like students that need to be in the gifted program, but their parents' jobs are changing. So maybe football practice after school wasn't an issue before, but it is going to be. What sort of ideas do you have for administrators and educators about systems we can put in place to take care of the changing face of extracurricular activities or those safety nets that catch students?
Depends whether it's elementary or secondary, okay? One of the things that I would look for One of the things that we talk about is not money, but we talk about resources.
Mm-hmm.
So resources are systems, they're links, they're whatever. And so one of the ways at secondary, you can just say, tell me, you can, if you have a good relationship with the kid, you can just say, you know, COVID changed everybody's life. Okay. And that's true. So as we think about what has changed in your life that would make getting to practice difficult, I would just be point blank, particularly for secondary kids. You just ask them point blank. Okay. Look, it changed everybody's life. It's not about shame. It's not about anything anybody did. It just changed everybody's life.
Yeah.
So the question is, what can we do now, or what do we need to do now, okay, to keep you in this program?
So good. Just put it out there.
I wouldn't be embarrassed about it. They'll be embarrassed if you're embarrassed.
Yeah.
You just say, you know, it changed everybody's life. It changed mine. Okay. Here's some things I've had to do differently. What are some things you're having to do differently? Okay. And it's just honest, you know. Yeah. For younger kids, I would, there's a technique that I love to give to counselors, since your audience is mostly counselors. And it's in that book, Emotional Poverty. It's called a metaphor story. And at the elementary level, you can use it with secondary too, but elementary, it's just magic for getting information out of kids. Like, have you ever watched a kid do something and you know they don't know why they're doing it and you don't know why either?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's this technique called metaphor story. It comes out of narrative therapy. And when I was a principal, I adapted it to use with kids, okay? And the rule is you never use proper names and you always end on a positive note, okay? So like, for example, I'll just give you an example so you know what I mean. You ask a lot of cause and effect questions. Okay. But the research is that if you don't use proper names, it goes underneath the conscious to the subconscious. And 60% of your memories are stored at the subconscious. Okay. So I had this fifth grade boy who was so smart, but every time there was a sub in the room, he went berserk. Okay. So I never saw him for anything but that. Okay. So finally I thought, this is insane. He's got a teacher that's sick a lot. I only see him when there's a sub. So I called him in one day and said, will you help me tell a story? He said, is this story about me? I said, well, it can be if you want it to be, but I'm not in the fifth grade. And you know, if you're over 30, they think you're ancient anyway. So I said, he said, sure. I said, once upon a time, there was a boy. The boy got along great at school, except when a sub came. And what did the boy do? He said to me, he threw paper, made jokes, and caused trouble. That's what he did. I said, what do his friends think? Because I thought maybe there was a reason he was doing it for his friends. Uh-huh. He said, they're confused. They don't know what to think.
Hmm.
I said, what does the boy do when he's the regular teacher's there? He sits in his seat. He pays attention. He takes notes. Why didn't the boy do that with the sub? I don't know. So I thought maybe there's a reason he wanted to come to the office. So I said, so what happens to the boy when he throws paper, makes jokes, and causes trouble? He gets sent to the office. What happens when he gets to the office? Well, the principal tells him that can't happen again. Well, I've been saying that and it works so well, right? So obviously, so now I'm stuck. And knowing that they bring in behaviors outside of school, I said to him, so what does the boy do at home? He said, depends which house he's in.
Mm-hmm.
So he, long story, lived in mom's house, dad's house, divorce. In his mom's house, he behaved one way. His dad's house, he behaved another. So all his life, he's learned you change out behaviors based upon who's in charge.
Mm.
I'm thinking he's going to use one set of behaviors because it's the same place.
Right.
That's a foreign idea for him. So what you do is you build a solution in the story. And you say, so the boy need to use one set of behaviors all the time because it's the same place.
Wow.
Okay. So the boy needs to use the set he uses with the regular. Can he do that? He said, yes. So we went over those behaviors. I said, what are those behaviors? So I finished the story this way. So the boy used one set of behaviors. He used the set he did with the regular teacher because it was the same place.
Okay.
The boy didn't get in trouble anymore. And the boy was very successful. I never saw him again.
That is incredible. That is incredible.
Yes. So you could say to a kid, it's amazing what you, I mean, every now and again you get stuck.
Sure.
And you ask every question you know. And then I usually said to the kid, wasn't that a lovely story, you know? But the bottom line is you find out a lot of ways. So once upon a time there was a boy, and the boy often wore the same clothes to school every day. Why did the boy do that? Mm. Or did the boy really like that shirt? Or do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You find out a lot that way.
Yeah, you're right. That is, I'm going to be using that for sure.
Well, it's wonderful. A principal told me she'd been in my workshop and she said she started using it on kids and now all her teachers bring her a kid and they go, do that Ruby thing on him.
Oh.
But it's another way to find out.
Well, I'm going to be using that on my own children too. I can see that working with them.
Well, I got to tell you one more thing. Oh, yeah, it works on your children. It works on like, adults, too. Like, you know, I remarried.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, when you live with somebody, you know, you kind of have the ability to irritate each other periodically, okay? One of the things I've done is every now and again, I'll say to my husband, you know, I have to tell you such a sad story. He goes, oh, no. What happened? I go, well, you know, there's this woman.
Oh, how funny.
And I said, and do you know what the woman did? He goes, no, what? And you, by the time you're done, you're laughing, okay?
Right. Well, okay, you just gave me some marriage advice, too. I'll be using narrative therapy on my husband, too, or metaphor. Well, I want you to tell us about some of the fabulous stuff that you have going on right now. I'm definitely ordering Emotional Poverty. That's going to be my next order. What else? I had seen that you have webinars and you've just got all kinds of things going on. So tell us some of your resources.
Well, one of the things that I would recommend to a lot of counselors who are in the audience right now is that the Emotional Poverty book, we have a training online and on demand, but we also have a training certification where we give you the PowerPoints and you can take it back and train your staff if everybody has a book. And what we are doing is the first book, Emotional Poverty. What I'm more worried about than anything else, quite candidly, is we're just losing teachers in droves.
Mm-hmm.
We're 400,000 teachers short last year. And the bottom line is they're leaving because it's too frustrating. They're dealing with children with all these emotional issues. People are giving them, they're doing trauma-informed care. They're telling them what it is, but there's no strategies for them to deal with it. Like, for example, one of the quickest things for your counselors to know, one of the fastest ways to calm down a kid who's upset and angry is to make them look at the ceiling. Because when your eyes are in that position, in this looking at the ceiling, what your brain is doing neurologically is accessing what is stored visually, and it's virtually impossible for your brain to get emotions.
Huh.
So the kid will calm down, okay? Well, there's a bunch of things like that, okay? So it looks at why do kids explode? How do you help them name their behaviors? What's the difference between a desirable behavior and a not desirable behavior? And the research is it's hard to change behavior, but you can change motivation for behavior. How do you do that? It's got a strategy for that. Then how can you, looking at the research on bonding and attachment, you can begin to do emotional triage. You can actually know where your shooters are going to come from.
Wow.
And where your suicides will tend to come from. I mean, and then, so you can triage, you can do some preventative things. Then there's a section in there on adult emotions. It's called emotional noise. Why some classrooms have a lot more issues than other classrooms. It's because adults bring emotions into the room as well. And it colors the room with the emotional reality. And we look at stages of adult development and how you go through very predictable stages of adult development and how that impacts your emotional reality. And the most dangerous age to be an adult is 35 to 45.
Wow.
More adults twist off in that age frame than any other age frame. Okay. We look at male brains, the difference between male and female brains and how they process emotion. The average female brain can process emotion in 2.5 minutes. The average male brain takes 3 to 5 hours. So yes, and the strategies for dealing with that. Okay, so you, and then we look at, so that's what that book looks at, how you begin to handle emotional realities very different and name them. And then the subsequent book, Emotional Poverty 2, which will be out in August, looks at the adolescent brain. It looks at body tells. Like, for example, if you want to know if a kid is telling you the truth or not, what would you say is the most honest part of the body to watch?
I would think the eyes.
That would be wrong.
Okay.
It would be their feet.
Okay.
And the reason is that their feet, you, when you have an emotional hit, the first place, and you would not be alone. That's what everybody says. Okay. So I always ask that question to get people's, and they'll go, but what happens is your emotional, the first emotional hit you have is on the brainstem. Your brainstem makes a decision. Am I going to run? Am I going to fight? Or am I going to flee? And run, fight, or freeze. And that, the first place that's reflected is in your feet.
Wow. Okay.
So when you know, so there's a whole bunch of, this is an FBI guy who did a lot of research on what bodies mean and the signals from bodies and what they mean. For example, when someone has an emotion, when they're emotionally upset, the body immediately self-soothes. And one of the most common ways to self-soothe is to rub your throat. There's nerve endings right there. So there's a lot of pieces there about how you watch the body. Then there's a section in there on, as I said, adolescent brains. There's a section in there on secondary stress syndrome, adults. You actually have an app on your phone that tells you exactly how much stress your body physiologically is actually under. And you can find out. So there's a lot of pieces in there for people. But again, I am heartsick about the number of teachers we're losing, because you can't have a strong country if you don't have good teachers for your children. And, yeah.
You are so right. And I can tell you are an educator at heart through and through, and that that is your passion. Your website, tell everybody your website so they can go to find these resources.
It's a www.ahaprocess, AHAPROCESS.com. Okay. The reason I named my company AHA, and I'm really sorry I did, okay, because people wrote on their evaluations, this was an aha for me, okay?
Yeah.
Right, well, then nobody knew how to answer the phone. Aha. Uh-huh.
Oh. I
mean, it was a problem, you know? But
I didn't think about that. How funny. Well, is there anything that we haven't covered that you want the audience to know?
The only thing is that when school starts again, it's going to take incredible levels of understanding and patience.
You are right. And that is something that we can be working on now. We have all this time to really, I just keep thinking, put these systems in place and work, flex our patience and flex our grace muscle, so that we're ready for these stories when they come back. Like you said, find the kids first so nothing catches us off guard. If a child is living in a tent, we know about it and we can be working on it now. So I feel like,
you know, at our price on our on-demand courses. So they're on our website, but we did it deliberately so that people would be able to handle what comes at them in the fall. The research is that the poverty rate in the world will climb to over 50%.
Wow. Wow. Well, and everybody has time right now to complete these webinars. So take advantage of this. And I certainly am. So you'll see my name come up as a participant. But thank you so much. I feel like you have packed 3 years of my graduate program into this session. I have learned so much from you today. So
thank you so much.
I can't wait for our listeners to hear this. And I can't thank you enough. It has been an honor to talk with you.
And for me as well. And thank you for all you're doing.
Yes.
It's good for all of us.
It is. Yes. Teamwork for sure.
Thank you.